on the road or off-road, Chevy Silverado is built for tough performance in any condition. Hit the road in a new Silverado pickup. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for a dealer near you. Chevy Silverado, official truck partner of the Chicago Bears.
Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. And this book, if you have a dog, probably at some point in time pertains or will pertain to you. Triggers and Reactions, A Guide to Fixing Dog Behavior Problems. This is Volume 2, Jumping, Barking, and Biting. Dog trainer Jeff Millman is here. These indeed, Jeff, are really common issues.
Yes, absolutely.
And the thing about it is, we'll take one at a time here, and we won't solve everything on the radio, which is why you need to buy the book. So let's take jumping first.
Yes.
That's a problem, and it could be two ends here. So we've got a dog that is just excited to see everybody, mm-hmm. no matter who they are, come over, but the jumping can knock grandma over. It can knock little kids over, right? So that's an issue,
right.
Even if the dogs are happy to see you, which is mostly the case. But there are a percent of dogs that are not so happy, and the owners don't have control, and the dog is being aggressive and jumping, which is even worse than the first. Neither one is good, so let's take one at a time. So if I were to right now Google a jumping puppy, mm-hmm. Google might tell me to do these things. Take the dog on leash and just say no and yank the dog and yank the dog. And before you know it, you've got a dog who thinks its name is no because you're saying that over and over and over. Or maybe sticking your knee up in the dog's thorax area. And that can work to prevent the dog from doing it. But the messaging for the dog may not be so great. So those are, I presume you'd agree, the wrong things to do. So what are the right things to do?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's three possible things to do in the moment, and then there's an ever-present, either zero or number four, however you're scaling it, of what's called shaping the absence of the behavior. And it's a very, very powerful concept. In the book, I have an example that illustrates the concept perfectly. My daughter had a friend, she's a teenager, and she had a friend that came over a few months ago, and my daughter told me that her friend was afraid of dogs. So I was ready, I was prepared, I knew when she was coming over, which is what I always recommend, is preparation and foresight. When her friend walked in the door, I, as you know from previous conversations, I'm a clicker trainer. You don't have to use a clicker, everybody, but it's just a really powerful communication tool. I clicked, which marks a behavior. At that point, my two English shepherds were looking at my daughter's friend about 10 feet away. I marked their behavior, which was standing. They weren't jumping. They weren't too close. They weren't barking. They were just standing and looking. Clicked and tossed a treat the other direction away from the front door into the kitchen. And then what happened is I did it again. They turned. They looked at my daughter's friend. I clicked. I marked that behavior, which was looking and not jumping and not being too close. Tossed a treat in the kitchen. Pretty quickly, they looked at my daughter's friend and said, yeah, whatever, where's my treat? And they went into the kitchen looking for treats. So that's an incredibly powerful, super easy concept, and that's one of many that you can read about in the book. But the point of my clients, you see, they get so comfortable and relaxed once they understand this. A lot of people say, my dog doesn't have to be sitting. Absolutely not. You're marking a behavior. At the end of the day, who cares if your dog is doing circus tricks as long as your guest is comfortable and your dog is comfortable? That's all that matters. If you want to do circus tricks, go to bed, you know, which is not too complicated. It talks about that in the book as well. Absolutely, but only if a dog is comfortable and lucid and able to actually think and control themselves. So that's one of the many, many possibilities that you can do. And there's just a few more simple strategies that I talk about. But if nothing else, everyone that hears this, all they have to do is throw a treat on their dog's back when they look at their family member coming in. As long as they're not too excited, they'll turn around because the treat caught their attention and they'll go collect the treat. Do that a few times. Eventually, the person at the front door is less interesting than what's happening behind them, and jumping doesn't happen. So that's one illustration of something that you can do.
Now, the philosophy behind that is, if the dog is jumping, you need to give something else for the dog to do. And that's what you're doing in a positive way as well. When you say circus tricks, I think in my head, all right, Aunt Dorothy comes over and now the dog rides a bicycle around the house. That's not necessarily important. Now, you mentioned clicker training and I let that go, yeah. But there are people who won't know what that is. Can you explain?
Right. Yeah, sure. It's just a little clicker. It's a noisemaker. It used to be a kid's toys way back when, and now it's used in the way that I use it to simply mark behavior. It always means a treat. So you click and then present a treat, and then you're marking behavior, and the dog, the goal is that the dog does something specific. They figure out that it resulted in the click and the treat, so then they do it again, and they repeat the behavior. When I'm working with reactivity, I mark their behavior, but then I analyze what happens right after that to ensure that they're comfortable and calm enough to continue being calm, in this case, when they look back at the front door at the guest. And at any point, guest takes one step closer, 1 second clicks by, that reactivity and control can change. So then you simply make an adjustment and say, okay, we're too close. Let's just move you away and work over here. So it's marking behavior always, but if you're working on reactivity, it's also analyzing to see if they can maintain their comfort.
So the disadvantage of a clicker is people don't always have one in their pocket, I suppose. And it does take a certain amount of skill or finesse or ability to think and do something else at the same time, which I do not have. So is it possible to do other things? And one thing for this particular issue that is often taught is give the dog a place. So someone rings their bell or knocks at the door and the dog knows to go, you said, to bed. That's okay. It could be a dog bed. It could be anywhere that the dog feels comfortable. And generally it works best if the dog can still see the door. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So that always for me falls under the category of make an adjustment if your dog is not able to be calm and comfortable, whether a dog is excited to see Aunt Susie or nervous that the plumber is coming into the house. If your dog is out of their mind, nervous or excited, obedience just simply is not going to work at that moment. So this is always assuming that your dog is under control, and there's very specific step-by-step strategies to reach that point in the book. But then once your dog is under control, you can have different commands. The two that I talk about in the chapter, useful commands, is simply come or go to bed. And the best way to do that is to practice with family members that come home from school every day or different things like that, and simply get the dog accustomed to seeing activity, hearing noises, and learning how to actually listen to their person and do what they ask. But go to bed is a really, really useful strategy, not only for keeping your dog under control, but also for mental stimulation, which is a huge component of making sure a dog is comfortable. Teaching them new things, whether it's go to bed or roll over or come when called or walk nicely on leash, those are all examples of obedience, which forces a dog to think, which is more tiring. And so go to bed is useful because it can move your dog around your house safely, but then also tires him or her out as well.
Now, I want to talk about, you mentioned that if the dog is so excited, so revved up, it doesn't matter how much obedience the dog has. These are my words, not yours, but I think the essence of that, you know, saying sit is not going to work at that point in time. Or hollering at the dog will not work either. So I want to talk about that a bit when we come back. We haven't talked about what else is in volume two here, and that's barking and biting, and we will with dog trainer Jeff Millman when we come back on WGN. The book is called Triggers and Reactions, A Guide to Fixing Dog Behavior Problems. Dog trainer Jeff Millman. We're just able to touch on these things, which are in volume two. You've been on the radio with us talking about dog reactivity on leash. That was volume one. Volume two, jumping, barking, and biting. So I want to talk about something you said, though, which is if the dog, and this I think refers to anything that's going on with the dog. If the dog is so excited in a good way or not a good way, then it is very difficult at that point in time, Jeff, to say, oh, sit for me. And it won't help either for you to scream at the dog. So what do you do to make it so when the doorbell rings or someone knocks at the door, the excitement level is a bit less?
Right. That's a great question. So it's a multiple part answer and strategy. At the heat of the moment, your dog is jumping, barking, you know, worried about biting. Management is the key, where I'm a big fan of just using leashes and harnesses, no choke chains or any of that stuff. Those are unnecessary. But just having your dog on leash, having it, him or her drag a leash if you're not quite sure where they are in their training ability at that moment. But if you expect them to respond to your command or the treat that you toss on their back when Aunt Susie comes over and they don't do it, then just gently grab the leash and move them away, and then make a decision at that moment whether you're going to switch to management, which is putting them in another area of the house or behind a baby gate, keep them on leash while your visitors are there, and that's totally fine as well. So that's kind of heat of the moment strategies. The proactive strategies that I, you know, strongly recommend everyone focus on is desensitizing them to the doorbell, door knocking. Make sure they don't bark out of the window at passerbys and delivery people, because that just gets them more and more fired up and can lead to something called barrier frustration, which is just wanting to interact with the outside world. Or same thing on leash, frankly, when they're on a walk, if they just can't get to something, frustration builds, and it's very, very counterproductive and difficult to get them to calm down and focus on you or focus away from what they're pulling at, or, you know, towards or barking at.
All right. The problem is you can't explain efficiently in the time that mm-hmm. we have desensitization and counter conditioning necessarily, and how you right. would do that. However, you could buy the book, Triggers and Reactions, A Guide to Fixing Dog Behavior Problems, Jumping, Barking, and Biting. Jeff Millman is the author. We haven't talked much. You just mentioned barking. So dogs bark. It's what they do. However, if you live in an apartment or condominium, that's not always a good thing. And my sense is that post-pandemic, we're even seeing more of this issue because we have more delivery people coming to the door.
Very good point. Absolutely.
So what do you do?
Yeah. So the key and the reason I came up with the name, and it's what I say all day long, Triggers and Reactions, is if what I counsel my clients, and, you know, when I'm with them, as I say, okay, as a family, everybody, if you look at your dog and say, I really don't like what they're doing right now, and it could be something that is completely not in their control, like simply feeling scared. I'm not blaming a dog when I make that comment, but the point is, if you don't want your dog jumping or barking or growling or potentially biting, they're reacting to something in the environment at that moment. It's your job as their caretaker and in person to notice what caused the reaction and work proactively or switch to management once again. So the proactive strategy is noticing as soon as they, for instance, turn towards the window where they are looking for the delivery person, if you're using a clicker and the recommended strategy that I talk about, if you click at that moment when they look outside of the window, if you are able to redirect them with the click and the treat, which the click always means a treat, at that moment, they're under threshold, which means they're not going to react. But then the person gets one step closer or 1 second ticks by, you have to reevaluate their response.
But in order to do that, the dog has to be understanding that the click means a treat, a really good treat, too, in the first place,
right.
Correct?
Exactly. So you would charge the clicker by just separately, without any triggers present, click. It usually takes five or less times. Click and just give your dog a treat. And then you know your dog is what's called clicker charged. When they look away from you and when you click, they immediately turn around towards the clicker in anticipation of the treat. Once that happens, you can use that information to understand what is catching their attention at that moment once they hear the click. If they ignore the click, continue looking at your guest, they're probably going to jump. If they continue looking out of the window, they're probably going to bark, things like that.
Now, we only have a couple of minutes left here, and of course, we didn't cover everything about jumping, barking either, but it's in the book. But biting, I'm not going to cover very much of, because my sense is that you can read about it in your book, but I'm an advocate, if the dog is truly aggressively biting, to get hands-on help, but to do one thing first, and that is make sure everyone is safe. So Aunt Susie, you mentioned, when she comes over, or you know she's coming over, ensure that the dog, at least for starters, is in another part of the house, and Aunt Susie is in another part of the house, so everyone is safe. That's, to me, step number one, and very often step number two, and you may disagree, is to bring in professional help for something that is so significant, because if you mess it up, if you don't do it, someone gets bitten. And if someone gets bitten, everyone loses.
Right. Yeah, no question. And I don't disagree. I would never criticize or tell somebody they should not have a professional over. That is absolutely an important part of this. The however comment is in the book. It stresses almost every single page, safety, 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 and then really doing setups where one of the examples I use is called guest peekaboo, where somebody, the person, you know, the person in the house is holding the leash, their dog is with them, their guest simply appears in a doorway, the person with the dog simply clicks and evaluates what their dog is doing, and they give them a treat, and then the person retreats, meaning out of view, they walk into the doorway again, and it could be 15 feet away, once again, totally safe. And what you're doing is just creating a classically conditioned response, which is dog sees person and they say, yippee, I love when that person appears in the doorway. And that's just one example of just a very basic process where you can do with any type of interaction. It even talks about how to build up to the point when, you know, treating and petting and all the different parts of guest interactions. But I stress over and over and over that it's a huge win if you have your dog on leash and your guest is 10 feet away and you're able to have a quiet conversation and everyone is enjoying themselves. Your dog does not have to get petted by everybody. Your dog doesn't have to be standing 2 feet away from somebody to be happy, comfortable, and, you know, part of the situation, part of the party or whatever the situation is. And then switch to management. Put him in another room with a bone or take him on a walk, let him catch his breath. It's all about slowly getting your dog incorporated into the routine, not, you know, forcing him and putting him over threshold where he just can't handle it. There's a lot of analysis of dog body language and different things in the book that you can learn.
But I'm concerned.
The precursor symbols.
Yeah, we're just running out of time here, Jeff. But I am concerned that a lot of dog owners may not necessarily understand those signals. There's a timing issue here that's significant.
Sure.
And if you mess that up with the jumping dog, okay, the dog jumps on someone, is excited to see. If you mess that up with a dog that's aggressive, which is typically fearful, and may even need a pharmaceutical. So I am a huge fan of bringing in a professional for that. I'm a huge fan of your work, Triggers and Reactions, A Guide to Fixing Dog Behavior Problems, Volume 2, Jumping, Barking, and Biting. Where can people get the book?
Right now, Amazon, and eventually all over.
All over, everywhere. Jeff Millman, thank you so much. Here are 12 ways to keep our pets safe over the holidays. Number 12, candles burn bright. Flickering candles can spark curiosity in our pets, but also spark a house fire. Number 11, good housekeeping. Some pets, especially puppies and kittens, like to munch on errant Christmas tree needles, so be sure we sweep them up. Number 10, avoid prickly Christmas tree needles in the first place. Douglas fir, white pine, they have softer, pliable needles, and they're easier to vacuum. Number 9, beware of where you kiss. Kissing under the mistletoe may be romantic for us, but in truth, mistletoe is toxic, more so than poinsettia plants. In truth, everyone talks about poinsettia plants. They're not healthy for pets, but mistletoe is downright dangerous. Number 8, stress is contagious. You get crazy frenetic, right, at this time of year. Well, your pets pick up on all that. So one way to let out that stress might be to play with your dog. Use an interactive toy with your cat, talk to your bird. All those things are great, but I will tell you, if you're stressed, your pets will be too. Number seven, meeting the relatives. That's not easy sometimes for us and sometimes for our pets. So while some pets are social butterflies, others are not. So for those who aren't, respect that. Allow the pet or pets to be in a second bedroom, a den, a basement. Pump up some classical music to help relax them. Maybe use a pheromone product as well. Number six, well, deck the halls. We all love our pets, and there's grandma syndrome all the relatives may have together. So while giving a little bit without the fat of turkey, chicken, or ham may be okay for our pets, if you add up what all the relatives give, that's not a good thing, and keep them away from the trash. They may dumpster dive. Even though typically they don't, you're not watching, you're busy, so don't let that happen. Number five, holiday treats to die for. Be sure to wrap up Aunt Rose's chocolate brownies for dieting Santa if the pets are nearby. The concern is that Aunt Rose, it might be a sugar-free product for her, and it may use xylitol. So now we've got chocolate and xylitol, a double whammy for our pets. Keep them away. Number four, tinsel, ribbon. Keep them away from that, too. Cats love playing with tinsels, so do some dogs, and if ingested, this can be life-threatening. Number three, keep the pets off the tree, the cats. A small latticework fence around the base of the tree might do the trick. Number two, the water that keeps the tree alive. You add these chemicals to it? That's not good for our pets, and maybe not even good for the tree, that I don't know. And number one, everyone loves getting presents, so be sure to give presents to your pets too. Happy holidays! Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN, and the name of this book is called Lab Dog, and it's not about Labrador Retrievers. In fact, Lab Dog, a beagle and his human investigate the surprising world of animal research. Melanie Kaplan is the author, and Melanie, typically a lot of people who interview other people ask, why did you write this book? And typically, I do not ask that question. But here, I think it's especially relevant. I mean, the interview that was at the first part of the show here was with a dog trainer. And we typically talk with veterinarians or dog trainers who write these books. You are not that. So I think it's relevant to know why you wrote this book in the first place.
Well, thanks, Steve. I adopted a beagle in 2013, and I knew that he came from some kind of research lab when I adopted him. He had a tattoo in his ear. He was really pretty scared of everything when I adopted him. And for many years, I just showed people the tattoo and explained that he came from a lab. And I really didn't know much more than that. But I'm a journalist, and I had lots of questions, and I just could not figure out answers. So I went on a journey of sorts with my beagle Hammy, and we tried to get some answers.
Well, and you did eventually, but I want to talk along the way about it, because you write about really what the history is of using dogs as lab animals, for lack of a better way of putting it at the moment. And you point out, for example, in 1966, Life magazine ran an 8-page photo essay entitled Concentration Camps for Dogs. And over the years, you write about how more and more, going on from 1966, closer and closer to where we are today, there has been more and more attention paid to this by the general public. And also more understanding about the need, or better put, the lack of need to use dogs for this purpose. Can you comment on that?
Sure. The Life magazine article that you mentioned, you know, in the 60s, dogs were being stolen from backyards to use for research. It was a really bad situation. This wasn't regulated at all. And that led to the Animal Welfare Act. And then the labs had to start being registered and counting the dogs. And we know that the number of dogs used in research and testing has really declined a lot. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of dogs used a year in labs a couple decades ago, a few decades ago. And today there's a little bit over 40,000 dogs, but that's still a lot of dogs. And what we're finding for all animal research is that there's a really big push to use non-animal alternatives, which means AI and computer modeling and human data, because not only are these animals beings with personalities and fears and, you know, they don't want to be confined, but we're also finding that the science is not that effective, particularly with some of the drug testing that shows up successful in animals, but not in human trials.
And it turns out the kind of testing, that's not the right word, the kind of science that is helpful are utilizing dogs that are already in homes for things like comparative medicine. Because it turns out, for example, dogs have now long been studied. They age similarly to humans. We don't have to do anything to them except watch them and better understand how they age, and we can better understand how we age. And then, yes, pharmaceuticals that are tried for us are sometimes tried for dogs first, or sometimes tried for humans first, based on that knowledge. Cancers, similarly, dogs get many of the same cancers we get just by living in the same environment, and they're mammals, but very, very closely intertwined with us. And the same with cats to a lesser degree. We don't have to do anything to them to use this kind of medicine. Am I making myself clear in how I say this?
Absolutely. And I think that's a really exciting area of research, because we do share our environments with dogs. So if we have pesticides from the neighbor's lawn and, you know, they're getting into the air that we breathe, they're getting into the air that the dogs breathe. The dogs might be walking on that grass. The dogs are exposed to all the household chemicals, and we actually share 350 or so diseases with dogs. So we have so much in common with them. And like you said, there are these aging studies like the Dog Aging Project.
Yeah.
And then there are studies where we can take dogs that have naturally occurring diseases, say they have a rare type of cancer, and there's actually a trial where you can take your dog in and have him or her treated, but not be a lab dog that's purposely bred to live in a lab.
Yeah, so it's a different way of thinking. And in fact, as one example, you mentioned cancer. So what comes to mind is osteosarcoma, which is bone cancer, which frequently occurs, particularly in certain dog breeds, but also occurs in children. And now, as just one example of what we're talking about, and there are many examples, a drug that was used for dogs and is used for dogs to slow the progression of the disease, and actually not so effectively, unfortunately, turns out to be far more effective for children who have bone cancer. And that wouldn't have happened without us studying dogs in a cancer that sadly naturally occurs in dogs.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And then also, a lot of drugs that are used in humans can be repurposed or tried with dogs, because you can imagine doing a clinical trial with a dog. There's not quite as much red tape and hoops that you have to jump through as with humans. They don't have to fill out consent forms, but of course their humans do. So I think it's really exciting, and there could be a lot more discoveries doing studies this way.
Now, Melanie, you're probably thinking, what kind of interviewer are you, Steve Dale? You're bearing the lead, as you journalists would say. You're not talking about Hammy. You're not talking about where this beagle came from. But I promise.
Let's talk about Hammy.
We will. But you know what? We're going to break for commercials first. And we're going to find out more about the beagles in labs. And my first question out of the box, which you address in Lab Dog, is why so many beagles in the first place? There are certainly other breeds and mixes in labs, but it's all about beagles. We'll talk about why Snoopy is so popular in labs when we come back on WGN. Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN, back with the author of Lab Dog, A Beagle and His Human, Investigate the Surprising World of animal research. Melanie Kaplan is the author of that book. Melanie, why are there, historically and to an extent, continue to be so many beagles? Why is it beagles that are, how can we do this to Snoopy? Explain.
Good question. You know, beagles are, as you know, docile and friendly, and they're really pretty compliant. So I think that is one of the reasons that they're used. But there's a long history, because beagles were brought over to the country after the Civil War to use in beagling, so the sport of hunting for rabbits using your beagle. So we had all these kennels of breeding beagles, and at a certain point that pivoted to breeding these dogs for pharmaceutical testing. You know, they're not huge dogs, so they don't eat a lot. They don't take up a lot of space, so I think that was convenient for the researchers, mm-hmm. and weren't spending a ton on feeding a Great Dane.
Yeah, and they also tend to get along well with other dogs. So here's my question. You adopt a dog named Hammy. Hammy has some issues, as in reality, it's just the reality. I want people to adopt dogs that were used in labs, but they don't all come. I mean, many come with some psychological issues because of the way in which they were raised. It doesn't mean they are not wonderful pets. Please continue adopting these beagles. And as you mentioned, beagles tend to be particularly docile, and eventually they do greatly settle in. However, you wanted to find out where your dog Hammy came from. And the way you write the book, Hammy was, if you were Sherlock Holmes, what was it, Dr. Watson or something like that? Mr. Watson? that's what Hammy was. And together, you kind of helped to figure things out and learned a lot about the world of dogs in labs. So what did you learn?
Well, I kind of joked that he was going to help me sniff out answers, but having him with me was important for a lot of ways. I mean, first thing, he was my co-pilot in everything, but it was important for me to introduce him to people, because we met researchers, for example, who'd never met a dog who was out of a lab. You know, they research on animals in the lab, and I wanted them to meet him and see that he's got a full life and he's got a personality, and he's not just a commodity to be ordered in the lab. And that's really the case with all these animals, right? They all have personalities and fears and likes and dislikes. But one thing I did learn is that these researchers believe they are doing the right thing. They think that they're making the world a better place. Many of them are working on some of these rare diseases and think that what they're doing is going to contribute to the advancement of science.
And I think that's true. And due to changes in laws, they do live in environments that are far more enriched and appropriate than compared to, say, the 1960s. It's still not like living with a family, however.
It definitely isn't. I would say that the best situations, the dogs have some toys. Some of them might even go for walks, and some of them are named. But some are not. Some don't get names, and some have very short lives before they're euthanized and their organs and tissues are studied. But as I'm sure you know, the dogs are the lucky ones. The mice and the zebrafish, they don't get names. They don't get toys. They definitely don't go out for walks.
Yeah, and it turns out that using mice in labs, we're diminishing that, because it turns out, as you said way early on, we are now understanding that this sort of thing isn't even necessary anymore, and we could do it better using today's technology. All right, so that's me speaking. We have just a couple, 3.5 minutes or so left. So in that time remaining, Melanie, what did you learn? And, you know, I say this at a time when so many labs are being forced by law to close.
So you're asking what I learned about the research?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think that a lot of scientists came up in this culture of, we have to learn about the human body through animals. And for a long time, for centuries, that was our only choice. And we've learned a lot. I mean, the drugs that we have today, the medical devices, the procedures, pretty much everything we know, we've learned from animals, from experimenting on animals. But we do have a choice now. And, you know, we've got hundreds of millions of animals in labs. And I think that we're moving in the right direction by replacing some of those with more effective technologies.
Mm-hmm. This is the most important question I can ask you. How is Hammy doing?
So, you know, Steve, I lost Hammy 2 years ago. He was 14, and I am just so thankful that we had a good decade together. Feels really special to have had that time with him out of the lab and to give him a really awesome life.
Would you recommend that more people, because we hear about these labs closing, or in some cases, unrelated but related in a sense, the puppy mill shuts down and all these dogs become available. Do you recommend that people adopt those dogs?
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned before that sometimes these dogs have issues, and that's true, but you could get a dog from a shelter who's got some issues too. I think the really important thing is that they need patient humans, people who are willing to spend a lot of time making sure their dogs feel comfortable and safe, and people who can be with them for long stretches. You know, I work at home, so Amy and I spent pretty much every moment together. But these dogs really do need better homes. So please do adopt.
You know, a former WGN personality, Roger Badish, who's now retired from the radio station, about the time he retired, or just before, just after, I don't recall, did adopt a laboratory beagle. As I recall, the dog came from a lab. And the dog is doing great, in part because the dog's name is Taylor Swift. So the dog has to do great, but this dog is is doing great things. And he is an example. He and his wife are examples of people. Yes, it took a bit of patience at first, but now this dog has settled in and is a wonderful member of the family. Your book is really interesting and certainly timely. It's called Lab Dog, A Beagle and His Human Investigate the Surprising World of Animal Research. Melanie Kaplan, thank you so much. Here it is now, the moment you've been waiting for all year. A dramatic reading. 'Twas a Pet's Night Before Christmas. 'Twas a Pet's Night Before Christmas and all through the house. Not a creature was stirring, especially the mouse, 'cause that mouse knows who's in the house. Oh, there's Fido, there's Fluffy, there's Duchess and King. On Rover, on Scruffy with that squeaky thing. Go by the red hydrant, run past those trees. Nothing can stop you, not even the fleas. They heard a tinkling on the roof. You know how reindeer are when you gotta go. The prancing of each little hoof. And then down the chimney, St. Nicholas, he was greeted with a purr, a bark, and a bite on his Nicholas. He came with squeaky toys, rawhide and liver to deliver. Oh, his eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, oh, how merry. When Rover licked his nose, it tasted like sherry. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team, he gave a whistle, and said, Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night. Happy holidays.